You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Thanks for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. This is Leah Eden, and I am your host today with a special studio recording. We're in the studio today with Emily Anthus, a science journalist who has written hundreds of articles for publications such as Wired, Slate, the Boston Globe, Scientific American Mind, and many other sciencey-sounded ones that I'm not super familiar with. She's also the author of a newly published book, I think just this past month, correct?
3 weeks ago,
Three
yes.
3 weeks? Oh,
yeah,
very exciting.
Early March.
Nice. Well, her book is entitled Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Oh, we're excited to have you here. And what a great book title.
Thank you.
A lot of fun. So we brought you in to talk about the book, Frankenstein's Cat, in which you explore how biotechnology is shaping the future of animals by breaking down the science and telling some really brilliant and some kind of odd stories about what's happening in the biotech sphere today. What sparked your desire to write Frankenstein's Cat?
Just my experience over the course of several years. I read a lot of science media, a lot of science press releases and studies, and it was starting to seem like every week I was seeing some new press release or study about some crazy thing scientists were doing to animals, you know, creating goats that made spider silk in their milk or remote controls steerable beetles. And I just got interested in what all these advances meant, and particularly what they meant for animals. It seemed like we spend a lot of time talking about what biotechnology means for humans, but I was interested in the question of, could these advances possibly help animals? Are they hurting animals? What does this mean for them?
Right. And in your book, you kind of introduce your audience to a number of different animals that illustrate, you know, biotech in that sphere and kind of what's going on today, not in the future. Can you give us an example or two of animals that you met that really stood out for you during your research, just to give us a sense of what kinds of things you were looking at?
Well, I think the whole world of farming, which is spelled with a PH, is really fascinating. That's a combination of the word pharmaceuticals and farming. And that's a relatively new but fast-growing field in which scientists are essentially trying to turn farm animals into living drug factories. They can genetically engineer, for instance, goats to produce important medical proteins in their milk, and then they can process the milk and extract the proteins, and you have human medicine. So that's just sort of a fascinating and astounding idea. It's growing really fast, and there are actually a couple of farmed drugs already on the market. So that's something that's here today and is likely to grow. I also looked at things like high-tech animal prosthetics, pets who are getting bionic limbs, cyborg beetles that the military is interested in perhaps using to conduct surveillance in war zones. It's a really wide range of innovations that I look at.
Oh, absolutely fascinating. Yeah, I was really amazed by how much of these things felt so sci-fi and felt like something maybe we were talking about could happen in 10, 20 years, and yet you're giving examples of things that have happened in the past already at this point.
Right. Well, I mean, one of the things I discovered was that science fiction is quickly becoming reality. And even more than that, what surprised me was I sort of knew going in that scientists were doing some of these things, but it turns out that some of these high-tech tools and products are now actually making their way out to the public. So it's quickly becoming something that not just scientists can play around with.
Oh, that's interesting. And so who, when you say out in the public, what kinds of people are starting to kind of get their hands on these technologies?
Well, there are a couple of different sort of ways in which these technologies are making their way out. And some is in the form of finished products. So things like farm animal drugs, or there's actually now a transgenic pet that's on the market in the U.S. It's called the glowfish, and it's been genetically engineered to fluoresce neon colors. And those are widely available at Petco, Walmart, $5 or $6 a piece. So those are finished products, but there are also companies and labs and organizations that are trying to make just the tools available to public, to the public. Here in Brooklyn, we have GenSpace, which is a community lab where people can play around with biotech. There's a company that sells a kit to construct a robo-roach. So anyone who wants to pay $100 can make their own remote control cockroach. So these are ways in which the experimental technologies themselves are becoming available to anyone who wants to pay a little bit of money.
So before we dive too much deeper into these issues and kind of what's going on, I want to sort of define a few of the terms so we're all on the same page. Because some of these terms I had heard of before, I'd probably even used, but I didn't have a real clear sense of what they meant. So for us non-science folks, what is biotechnology?
I'm not sure there's one clear definition. I defined it pretty broadly. I think some people might limit it to meddling with an animal's genes or genome itself. So that would be genetic engineering and cloning. I also expanded it to include cybernetics, so implanting electrodes and electronics in the brain. I include wildlife tracking, which some people might not include, because that's essentially implanting or attaching little computers to animals' bodies. And I also included prosthetics, because they're now becoming so sophisticated that we're seeing animal prosthetics that are permanently implanted into an animal's body. So for me, it was really broadly defined as any way that we're using technology to reshape an animal's form or to meddle with its body.
Okay. And then genetic engineering or genetic modification is another term that we hear kind of thrown about in a lot of different ways. Not always in ways that I think are fully understood about what we're talking about. So what, in your mind, based on your research, what is genetic engineering or genetic modification?
So I use it mostly to talk about our new molecular genetic tools. You could say, for instance, that dogs are genetically modified because we have quite literally altered their genes by breeding them. But I think when most people use it, and the way I use it, means to use some molecular biology tool to alter an animal's DNA. And sometimes this means taking a gene that's not in the animal's body normally and putting it there, but it can also be broader than that. It's maybe altering the expression of a gene, so turning essentially the volume of a gene up or down, a gene that's present naturally. Even things like gene therapy, in which we treat a disease by sort of injecting a functional gene into a patient, is a form of genetic engineering.
Right. And that was one of the things that was really fascinating to me, is when I've heard genetic engineering or talked about it myself, I think I've seen it in a very narrow definition. And so it was interesting to see it kind of broaden to see what else could be done in that space. And in the book, you draw this comparison between the high-tech genetic modification we've been talking about and breeding that took place in, as you said, dogs. And, you know, my own puppy at home is actually a labradoodle, so the result of crossing a Labrador retriever and a poodle to get a hypoallergenic dog, so my husband is not sneezing constantly.
And I have a Cavapoo, which is also a poodle mix with a Cavalier King Charles Spaniel, so I'm familiar with the crossbreeds.
Very nice. So, you know, we get the concept of sort of breeding to produce specific desirable traits, which is in some ways very much what we're talking about. But I'd like to hear you tell me a little bit more about how you think about the connection or the difference between selective breeding, which, you know, farmers have been doing for generations and generations, or conventional breeding, and genetic modification through biotechnology.
This was a question I was really interested in exploring in the book, which is, to what extent are our new tools just an extension or outgrowth of what we've been doing for millennia? And in some ways, absolutely, they're just part of a continuum. And the impulses certainly are the same. We are trying to alter animals for the same reasons we've bred them, which is for aesthetics or to produce better meat or to be functional to humans in some better way. The biotechnological tools, though, have some important differences. They give us much more precision, they allow us to control the genome with much more precision. So crossbreeding, say a lab and a poodle, is sort of educated guesswork. You know, you're going to get some mix of the traits, but you're not sure which ones exactly, and there's a lot of variability in the outcome.
And my dog certainly does shed a lot. So.
Yes, as does mine. So, but with genetic engineering, you can go in and pick one specific gene and turn it on or off. It also allows us to create combinations that might never exist in nature. So, for instance, scientists have taken a gene from a jellyfish and put it in a kitten to make a cat that glows neon green. Obviously, that's something you're never going to get by trying to breed a cat and a jellyfish together. That's just not going to happen. And it also allows us to make these changes much faster. I mean, it took millennia to create the dog breeds we have today from the gray wolf. But now in just weeks or months, we can create entirely new creatures. So there's definitely an intensification of the power we have over an animal's body.
Right. And, you know, as we said before, there are these really fascinating and in some way kind of crazy things that are happening out there in the biotech space with animals. Why do you think the public doesn't hear about a lot of these scientific advances? It really feels in a lot of ways that the scientific community is in some way segregated from public conversations. Was that something that you explored in your research?
I was actually surprised to the extent that the scientists themselves were saying they wanted to engage with the public more and engage in these debates. I think it's hard for them. There is a lot of coverage of these individual breakthroughs, you know, one story somewhere about a glowing cat, but often they're not put in context. So I think it's difficult to have a conversation about what all of these technologies mean together. You know, I'm sympathetic to the daily journalist. I've written for newspapers, and if you have 800 words, you can't really get into the history and the, you know, the whole context of those things. But many scientists said to me they were happy to have discussions about the ethics of their work, and they sort of hoped society could have more of those discussions.
That's interesting. Well, I recently read a review of your book that said that, you know, quote, "It's an important one precisely because of that visceral reaction we all feel in response to the very idea of biotech. It's a no bullshit account that looks at the way biotechnology is used today, separating fact from fiction and explaining what you need to know about this thing that creeps us all out." And I think that brings up a really interesting point. In your book, you talk about this yuck factor, that hearing about the cloned pets or the cyborg insects, the drones, just kind of creeps people out. And without being a very rational or logical argument, people feel like there's something inherently wrong or unnatural about it. Where do you think that emotional reaction or that anxiety about biotechnology comes from?
Probably a couple different places. On the one hand, there are very sort of logical objections and concerns that get raised about animal welfare and human welfare and the safety of ecosystems if these animals got loose. But as you point out, there's also this emotional response that sometimes defies logic. And I think some of it comes from what I was just mentioning, how biotechnology allows us to create new creatures much faster than before. Whereas, you know, maybe over the course of generations, we had the chance to get used to the idea of selective breeding. Suddenly, here we have this glowing cat in front of us, and it doesn't look like anything we've seen before, and it doesn't look like anything that happens in nature, so it seems wrong maybe somehow, or certainly unnatural. It's not something that would happen without our intervention.
Right, and in a lot of ways, it felt like Frankenstein's cat was sort of your attempt to move the conversation around biotechnology and animals beyond being this black or white issue. You know, it's good, it's bad, it's right or wrong, because it is a very divisive issue for a lot of people. And you brought up the some of the concerns that people have beyond that yuck factor, whether it be health or safety issues, environmental concerns, animal welfare. I could keep going. What are some of the concerns that you've personally felt through doing this research?
Oh, I've felt all of those things. And I come out of the book and I came out of my research with some optimism for the future. I think it's fair to say it's an optimistic book, but that's not because I think all biotechnology is automatically awesome and that it's going to solve all our problems. It is such a wide ranging technology, and there's so many different ways to apply it, that it seems to me sort of pointless to make a blanket statement like it's always good or it's always bad. That's sort of meaningless. But there are certainly ways in which we can use it to do damage. There are cases in which animal welfare has been compromised, where perhaps the product is not safe for humans, where it is going to be a risk to the ecosystem. all those things can absolutely happen. And there are cases in which I had all those concerns. But the important thing for me to point out was that not every application or product raises those same concerns. And not every engineered animal is going to suffer or be dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Well, I recently spoke with a poultry farmer who practices selective breeding. And when I asked him about how his practices were different from companies that raise genetically engineered chickens or turkeys, he talked about the intentions of the person conducting or practicing the breeding or the genetic modification, about kind of the goal. And the way he explained it was that his aim in selective breeding was to create a balanced, healthy animal, one that could mate naturally and walk around and be delicious and nutritious. And from his perspective, he felt that GE patent holding companies, their motivations were about rates of growth and profit and money. And for him, that was a really big distinction. And I'm wondering, where does money kind of come into this argument for you personally from the kinds of things that you saw in the research?
That's an interesting question. And I think that's a source of part of the concern about biotechnology, is because it is so wrapped up in these corporations. And corporations often do nasty things in pursuit of profit. I mean, that's a fact. What I try to do, and I hope that people are able to do, is to separate the issues inherent to genetic engineering with the issues that are raised by, you know, corporate control of the food supply. There's nothing technically to prevent us from using genetic engineering to the same ends, for healthy, well-balanced chickens, for instance. But those goals do get more complicated when there are patents involved and companies involved. I'm not trying to say that all companies, you know, are evil and have this, you know, care about nothing but profits, but it does complicate the picture, and the issues are entangled, but they're not quite the same.
Right. And I think that is a space that gets a little bit more murky, and can really kind of taint a lot of the good and the positive things that are coming out of that biotechnology space. And that was one of the strongest things that I came away after reading your book with. So I thought that was a really powerful message.
Can I add one more thing?
Of course.
Which is that sometimes things that corporations might do for the wrong reasons might still be the right outcome. So they might be interested in engineering a healthier chicken solely because it's more profitable for them if they don't have to provide veterinary care and all those sorts of things. Now, that's not necessarily the best motive, but it might still be the right outcome for the chickens.
Right, and that's where I think the complexity comes in a little bit more. So we could talk about this for a very long time. We're going to take a very quick break, and we're going to come back and talk a little bit about where in the biotech space, who is currently focused on developing GE foods, animals for human consumption. So thanks for listening to the Heritage Radio Network. We're talking with Emily Anthes. And when we come back from break, we're going to get into it a little bit more. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Shapeshifter by Knife Show on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Welcome back. This is your host, Leah Eden. You're listening to the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We're back in the studio with Emily Anthes, the author of the recent Frankenstein's Cat, cuddling up to the bio to biotech's brave new beast. Excuse me, it's a bit of a mouthful.
It is.
So, Emily, you recently kind of inserted yourself into this current debate around the Food and Drug Administration's consideration of the Aqua Advantage Atlantic salmon. And for those who aren't familiar, it's a fish created by the Boston-based company called Aqua Bounty. It's a genetically engineered salmon that's in the last stages of getting potentially approved for human consumption by the FDA. If the FDA does approve this GE salmon at the end of April, it'll be the first GE animal to be in our food system. And Emily, you recently wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times. Sort of, at least my take on it was sort of encouraging the public not to fear genetic engineering as a blanket statement, and voiced your support for the FDA's approval of this salmon. And I'm wondering, for our listeners who didn't read your op-ed, can you briefly give us an idea of sort of why you decided to write it and what your position was?
Sure. You know, obviously, this is a controversial issue, and of course, I got lots of emails after the op-ed.
That's my next question.
And I think some people, I mean, it was hard to get into the nuances of all, it's a very complex subject, and you know, you have 800 words. I think some people misunderstood what I was advocating and thought I was advocating for these fish, for everyone to eat these fish, that I was a personal supporter of these fish solving all our problems, and so on and so forth. To be honest, I don't really care about these fish at all. Like, I could take or leave GM salmon. What concerns me is when politics trumps science. And the reason I decided to write the op-ed is because there seems to be some evidence in this case of the GM salmon that politics has been derailing and delaying and overruling good science. And to me, that's a really dangerous precedent. You know, I could take or leave these salmon, but what about the next product that comes along that might have more benefits? I think if we start getting into this area where a handful of vocal activists can sort of overrule the data, that's dangerous.
Right. And there was an interesting point that you made about kind of the politics delaying it. I think there are a lot of people who, well, I think before we get into the controversial part of it, because it is really controversial and it is very interesting, if you could very briefly kind of explain the actual science behind the Aqua Advantage salmon, because I think that is also a point of misunderstanding in a lot of ways for some people.
Sure. So this is an Atlantic salmon that is engineered to reach its adult size twice as fast as normal. It grows to adult size in a year and a half instead of in 3 years. Often this is misunderstood or portrayed as a salmon that grows to enormous sizes, the super-sized salmon. That's not the case. It's the normal salmon size that just gets there faster. And scientists achieve this by inserting two foreign pieces of DNA. They took a growth hormone gene from a different species of salmon, the Chinook salmon, and they put that in. And they attach the growth hormone gene to a genetic switch, a piece of DNA that turns the growth hormone gene on and off, that comes from another fish called the ocean pout. This is a fish that lives in really cold water. And the result is this growth hormone gene in the GM salmon gets turned on in cold weather, in cold water, in the winter. Normally, the salmon just make growth hormone in the summer. But with this genetic modification, they make growth hormone year-round, and as a result, they grow faster.
Okay. And you do talk a little bit about this specific example in your book. During your research, were you able to speak with anyone from the company or visit the site?
You know, I didn't, and it's funny because I sort of intentionally didn't spend a lot of time on food in the book, partly because I felt like so many other people were covering food already. But of course, that's the debate that's going on right now. And I spoke to a lot of independent scientists who have reviewed the company's data, and they were all saying that the data is solid, the fish are low risk, we should go forward. And that's those are the conversations that informed my opinion.
Right. Okay. And, you know, I've been doing a lot of reading about the GE fish as a non-scientist, as a consumer, as an eater, as someone who's curious about it, because I think its approval or its denial is really significant. You know, we've got a number of GE crops currently out in the marketplace. We are eating them without knowing it all the time. And yet there's something different about a GE salmon being approved. It's going to be the first whole animal approved for our consumption. And so, you know, I think it sort of deserves potentially even more critical review. And, you know, you say as much in the book. But I'm not thoroughly convinced that there has been enough evaluation. And I think that is one of the main concerns that I've heard coming from some of different organizations or, you know, people that are advocating for more time. And, you know, from my understanding, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on it or if you, you know, got any more insider information. But from my understanding, the FDA reviewed a study provided by Aqua Bounty, the company that will make money off the fish, and looking at like a fairly small number. And so I'm just wondering, in your research, was there any conversation around this? Or do you feel like that's a place that concerns you or kind of... Where do we go from there?
Well, there are a couple different questions in there. I'll try and address them all. If I miss one, let me know. But yes, much of the data does come from Aqua Bounty, which I'm happy to admit is not ideal. Unfortunately, or fortunate, I mean, just it's a matter of fact that that's the way our regulatory system works. Drug companies provide data about their own drugs. Manufacturers of food additives provide data about their own food additives before they're approved. I mean, I'm not sure what the alternative is. It's certainly not going to be the federal government funding studies into every single new food product that comes through. So, I mean, that's not to say that's an ideal situation. That's just a practical reality. I guess I was reassured by several things. One is that there are independent scientists who have looked at the fish, who have reviewed the Aqua Bounty data, who have no financial interest in this being approved. They've see no issues with the methodology, no issues with the data collected. The other thing, and maybe this is what really convinces me more than anything, is there's not really a plausible mechanism by which these fish could cause, and now I'm talking about human health, not environmental issues, which is separate. There's not really a plausible mechanism by which the fish could cause harm. They've, you know, sort of the most likely you might think of is, are we eating fish with, you know, super high levels of growth hormone, and what might that do? Well, so far, the studies show that the level of growth hormone in their tissues is within normal range. And what's more, even if it weren't, the receptors we have in our bodies don't fit with fish growth hormone. So there's not really a plausible biological mechanism for that to cause harm. I think I'd be more concerned and want to see more study if I could see a theoretical case for what damage this will do. And so far, I haven't seen even the critics articulate what it is that is going to happen. One big concern, and it's a real concern with GM foods, is the allergenic issue. You know, that has, particularly with crops, there was a proposal, I believe, to put a gene from a Brazil nut in some sort of grain crop. And that didn't go forward because people realized that there are people out there with nut allergies and it could be incredibly dangerous to have this Brazil nut protein in you know, something else. But in this particular case, you're taking one salmon gene and putting it in another salmon gene and another species of salmon. That's not likely to be the same issue. Finally, I guess I would say that I make no promises, and I think this independent scientists make no promises that this is 100% risk-free. I don't think anyone claims that. But neither is a lot of food on our food in our food supply. So I sort of think we have to ask what's a reasonable amount of proof and what's a threshold of proof, level of risk. You know, certainly people argue there hasn't been enough data, and you know, there hasn't been a 50-year long-term study, but is that practical? Is that reasonable? That's a standard that we don't actually ask any food in our food supply to meet, genetically modified or not. So those are the things that influenced my opinion. I know not everyone is on board with that. And, you know, I don't feel like anyone should be forced to eat this fish if they don't want to. But I think there is enough data out there for me that the company now should be able to put their fish on the marketplace and let it compete on the marketplace. If consumers don't want it, that's, you know, consumers' right.
Right. And, you know, I do want to kind of get back to that regulatory issue. Because from my understanding, it seems as though the rules and regulations are a little bit outdated based on the kinds of science and the kinds of technology tools that we have today. You know, the GE salmon falls under animal drug, you know, and it seems as though it's a way to use an existing law to deal with a new product without actually creating something new. And, you know, I'm wondering, all GE animals kind of fall under this animal drug provision, regardless of whether they're for human consumption or the glowfish pet.
Right.
And as you've talked about, the field of biotechnology is advancing so incredibly quickly. Do you feel like it's possible for the rules and the regulations to kind of keep up with what's going on in that field?
No. So far, they have not kept up, and I'm not sure. I think the science will always move faster than the regulatory process, which is a big concern. And that is, in fact, one reason this approval process for the salmon has taken so long is scientists started creating GM animals in the 80s, and it wasn't until 2009 that the government even issued formal guidance for how to get these products approved. It took them forever. And as you point out, instead of writing a new regulation, they sort of figured out a way to work GM animals into an old regulation. And there's been a lot of criticism of that from people on both sides of the debate who wonder if this is really an appropriate way to regulate these animals, especially when you think about, you know, even when you're talking about a food animal, it's not just food issues that are at stake. It's environmental issues. And, you know, should fish and wildlife be brought in? I think these are important questions. And I think there might be a better way to regulate these animals, though I'm not a policy expert and I'm hesitant to make a specific recommendation.
Well, I think this is part of a much bigger conversation that maybe isn't happening right now, and potentially, you know, don't know what's going to happen on April 26th with the FDA's decision process. I think there's a lot of people who do believe that it will be approved, whether they're happy or not happy about it. Hopefully that will lead to some larger conversations about the regulatory system and kind of what's in place and what's not in place. So we are just about out of time. But I have one last question for you. As the GE salmon is getting closer and closer to this potential approval, a number of restaurants and companies like Whole Foods, Trader Joe's have made this promise not to carry GE salmon if it's approved. And I'm wondering, from your interactions with the scientists or companies that are involved in this biotech space, if the consumer market isn't as large or as financially advantageous as expected, what is that impact on a company like Aqua Bounty or on the biotech industry in general?
Slightly different in each case. I think it's clearly devastating for Aqua Bounty, which has put all of its eggs in this basket, so to speak. You know, and that's a risk that they've sort of signed up for all along. When you're the first in this space, you can cross your fingers and hope, as I'm sure they're doing, but there's no guarantee that consumers will embrace it. For the biotech industry in general, I think it would be sort of have a negative effect on others interested in GM food animals. It would be a strong indication that people don't want to eat these foods. I think it would be less damaging to other sorts of pursuits, like, for instance, GM animals for medicine or other kinds of applications. I think there'd be less of an effect there because that's sort of a different function, and I think consumers might have different feelings about it.
Okay. Well, Emily, I really appreciate you coming out into the studio today to talk about how biotechnology is shaping the future of animals and potentially our food system. Your new book, Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts, is a fascinating and surprising read. I really enjoyed it and sort of opened my eyes a little bit to thinking about biotechnology in a different way. This is Leah Eden, and I've been your host this afternoon. This has been another special recording on heritageradionetwork.org. If you missed even a moment of today's conversation, it's available free on our website, like all of our 30 live weekly shows at heritageradionetwork.org. You can also check out our shows on iTunes or Stitcher. If you like what you hear and want to support us, click that donate tab and become a member today. Thank you so much for listening, and keep coming back.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.